Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Esther Kismödi, and I am the chief executive of SRHM. While respecting, protecting, and fulfilling sexual and reproductive health and rights remains a day-to-day concern, wars such as the war started on February 24 against Ukraine call attention to those issues that need action immediately and to the needs and rights of most vulnerable people who need to be protected now. We reached out to experts and colleagues to discuss the impact of war against Ukraine on sexual and reproductive health and rights and created this podcast episode. While we acknowledge and are deeply concerned about all wars happening around the world at the same time, now, this podcast episode focusing on the nuances of SRHR in relation to the war against Ukraine in 2022. We cover issues related to access to sexual and reproductive health services for those who stayed in Ukraine and those who seek refuge in other countries. We cover issues such as surrogacy that raises particular health, safety, legal, and human rights concerns, and we discuss the nuances of humanitarian support and the nature of international humanitarian and human rights law as it applies to such a situation like the one is happening in Ukraine. We also acknowledge that certain population groups, such as people living with disabilities, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex populations, and people belonging to certain racial, ethnic, and religious minorities may face particular dangers in relation to their sexual and reproductive health and rights in this war situation, and we tried to raise the particular concerns applicable to them. In addition to this podcast, we recently published an editorial on the implication of wars on sexual and reproductive health and rights. The editorial is available at srhm.org. We hope you enjoy this episode. I'm very pleased to welcome here Dr. Galina Majstrok from Ukraine on the 14th of March when we are doing this interview. Hello, Galina.
Hello.
Galina is an obstetrician gynecologist and the head of the Women's Health and Family Planning IPPF Member Association in Ukraine. Thank you so much, Galina, for being with us today in this very, very difficult and heartbreaking situation happening in Ukraine. Can you please start telling us about what are the main sexual and reproductive health concerns that people are facing today in Ukraine? We hear about the bombing, the safety, the life and death situation. We heard about the bombing of different maternity hospitals, but we would be very, very pleased to hear from you that what are the sexual and reproductive health issues people are facing?
I can say that my some big concerns is destroying of the system, because we have not bad system of services for women, from maternity to all family planning services. We were one of the countries who was very progressive in implementing reproductive health services. And also we were the country who was very active in presenting of safe abortion concept in Ukraine, comprehensive care of unwanted pregnancy. We were doing it together with WHO. Now Ukraine looks very different because it's different regions who are affected by active military operations, like Russians say, which faced with the bombing, with really aggressive behavior of Russian troops regarding civil population, destroying of infrastructure. And now looking at the reports of the Ministry of Health of Ukraine, I can say that more than 50 hospitals are destroyed completely now. They don't exist anymore. More than 100 destroyed partially. And they don't say how many maternity houses, because as we know, famous Mariupol, as we know, Volnovakha, it's a big list of hospitals that are already not functioning, which were providing services for, first of all, maternity, and then for children. Taking in account that I don't know to whom trust, because the UN Agency for Refugees talking about 5 million of refugees, some other agencies talking. I trust to our Ministry of Foreign Affairs because people are crossing the border, and it looks like it's 3 million people now outside of the country. And mostly it's women and children, because men between 18 till 60 can't leave the country because they need to go to the military service. That's why mostly people who are leaving, this is women and child. Inside of country, we have a lot of IDPs. It's people who are internally displaced people. When this aggressive Russian troops give green corridors, which takes a lot of time to get for them, we get new IDPs, it's women and children. And as I know, they are in a very poor condition because sometimes people don't eat 4 or 5 days. And what's going on? A lot of people go to the neighboring regions because Ukraine is a big country. By the territory is more than France. And by population, it was before the war near 40 million people. And I can say that women are giving birth in metro stations. They are giving birth in shelters, which are not safe. And the problem is what's going on after this, where you will go with newborn. To deliver, it's only one story. And when you go with a newborn, to what kind of service?
Galina, can I ask you, so you said that so many hospitals have been destroyed and healthcare facilities. What is the emergency preparedness? Healthcare providers are in the same danger than the general population. So how the health system is getting...
We are living in a country who has this war on the territory of Lugansk and Donetsk for 8 years. It's not the beginning of the war without a preliminary war. We have this situation. But preparedness, I can say that our health system is functioning, it's working, because it's still governmental. And people continue to stay on places when it's possible. As I know, 13 doctors already are killed. I don't know how many nurses are killed. But more than 40 ambulance cars were shot by Russian troops. And some of the doctors were killed in these ambulance cars.
And Galina, what an organization like yours, who is an IPPF...
Actually, we are not a big organization, but we are working now on information component. We are working a lot on information component. We have experience working with UNFPA on a GBV project during the war and on humanitarian. We are also members of their humanitarian groups and try to bring in Ukraine humanitarian aid. We are on the places, we know the needs, we are in a contact with the regions. I try to help now occupied by Russian troops Kherson to bring milk to newborns. It was my task 2 days ago. I was speaking with maybe 100 of people, how it can be organized, what can we do in this case, etc. Actually, we are working now in humanitarian aid. We are looking on possibilities with IPPF Brussels to bring needed supplies for maternity. And it was also my big work with IPPF Brussels, etc., etc. I can say that I was never busy like now, the whole day, and maybe much more in communication, because in a peaceful time, our task was sexuality education, our task was contraception, our task was youth protection, youth programs. Unfortunately, now agenda changed dramatically.
And what are the needs, Galina, that the international community could provide? What
I all time say about land lease. During the Second World War, Stalin army will never win in Second World War without help of United States and other. It was a breach which was bringing. It's not like one time you help, because it's needed all the time to organize this bridge between Western world and Ukraine to support population in medications, in food for now, and in some important life supplies, even like coats, like something, because people left from their own home, their homes destroyed. In this case, I very much really appreciate this open hands of the Western world to our refugees, to people who are now in Europe. I am sure that somebody may stay longer, but I am sure when it will not be dangerous, people will go back, because motivation is very high of people to go back to Ukraine. But at this time, extremely important is to save children and to save mothers. Because I know that without men, we can't move in the world. But the basis of the world is mothers and children.
Thank you so much, Galina. I really, really appreciate your availability. And I hope we can be in touch and our community and in solidarity and assistance in as many ways as we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My second guest on this podcast episode is Wanda Nowicka, who is a Polish activist and politician, member of Parliament of Poland. She co-founded and was the first coordinator of ASTRA, Central and Eastern European Women's Network for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights. Hello, Wanda. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Esther, for having me here. Thank you so much.
Wanda, Poland is doing remarkable in providing refuge for many of the Ukrainian refugees and providing all kinds of services and all kinds of help. Can you please tell us in general about the situation, how Poland is doing in relation to providing assistance for Ukrainian refugees?
Yes, Esther, this is really a big issue. Of course, the war itself is a terrible thing that is happening. But as a result of that, there is at this point, so after almost 20 days of the war, when war has started, about 1,800,000 refugees from Ukraine came to Poland. Not all of them certainly stayed in Poland. A number of them went to other countries. But still majority of them are staying in Poland. And from the very moment, people spontaneously started to organize and help Ukrainians by collecting goods, by providing food, by providing shelter, by inviting them to homes. There was really, let's say, spontaneous national effort to help those people, people in terrible situation who all of a sudden lost everything.
Wanda, you just told me that the Polish parliament just passed a law that also has an implication of access to health services. Can you please tell more about that?
Yes, because of course, this spontaneous effort will not last forever. There is a need and there has been a need for systematic support. Therefore, the Polish parliament has adopted the legislation according to which every Ukrainian citizen who came after the war started has access to healthcare, to education, to shelter, to some financial support. The person will be allowed to be employed legally in Poland. And people will receive the ID number, which certainly will help them to navigate around the country. Of course, this is very needed. However, of course, this is a huge, huge effort on the government institutions and local governments as well.
So how this law will be applicable to sexual and reproductive health services, if you may be able to know already?
The law includes access to health care, which, of course, according to the Polish health law, it includes sexual reproductive health care. So by that, the access will be given. And certainly there are already, there are already people, especially women, who will need this health care. Because what is very important to be aware of that the profile of refugees is such that they are primarily women with children and elderly people. There are men, but they are much, much less. Nobody has statistics, but that's the number. So basically, there already have been women who needed obstetric care because they give birth to children or they are pregnant or everything which is connected with pregnancy. That certainly has already started. And women are going to hospitals and getting service in this particular aspect of reproductive health.
And what other aspects of sexual and reproductive health and rights your country and the refugees are facing in this situation?
Another very important aspect is the fact that the services are provided according to the Polish law. And as you probably must have heard, as far as, let's say, abortion or contraception. Abortion is almost not existent in Poland anymore. Contraception is very limited. Poland is last on the list of countries where access to contraception is limited. But abortion is a huge problem, which is practically illegal. And here, already these problems have started with women who expect having those services which they would receive at home, if not war. So I know of stories of women, a fetus was badly deformed and she expected that abortion will be accessible. But that then, of course, it turned out it's almost impossible. So these problems have already started and the problems are even bigger because many Ukrainian women have no idea what is the law in Poland? What is access to services? They expect more or less that this access will be more or less the same like Ukraine, where you have access to abortion, you have access to morning after pill, which is also problematic in Poland. And this is not the case. So here the problems have started already and they are going to grow, that's for sure.
And in your experience, Wanda, I mean, it's a problem for Polish women as well. So what are the consequences of not getting safe abortion services and how it will be even more difficult and impacting women's health for the refugees?
I wanted to add that in Poland, there are women's groups which support women in getting abortions, either by going abroad or by providing abortion pill. And they already have started some time ago when refugees of different kinds started to come to Poland, that they already provide services to refugee or before it was immigrant women. So that's the situation that we have very drastic law, access to services limited and for Polish women and subsequently to all newcomers. But those who provide those services in need are women's groups, which are quite limited. Their services are, of course, also limited, but they are the ones who support women. And I talked to those colleagues of mine about conversations with women. So, you know, they just call and say, we need this and that without discussing. And some others are just shocked that they cannot access easily what they would in their country. So I am afraid that many Ukrainian women, despite all support they will get in Poland, would get in Poland from institutions, they might really be disappointed and sometimes hurt by the fact that they are in the country where women are so badly treated, and also those other women who are not Polish, but happen to be in Poland. So that will be a serious problem and crisis. That's what I expect.
So based on what you are saying, Wanda, there are a lot of opportunities and there are very positive efforts that the Polish government is providing, although it's very challenging. And women will face difficult situations because of the law. So who are the actors and what are the accountability measures that you are expected to be implemented in immediate term and in a longer term as the situation evolving?
I would say that despite the engagement on the government and other actions it took and parliament who passed the law, still the major actor is the civil society, our organizations, humanitarian organizations and ad hoc groups that have started that now support and help refugees in everything what they need. So here you have all actors. But as far as sexual reproductive health and rights, Ukrainian refugee women may count only on women's networks and those who work with them, because these are the ones who are trying to help in getting services women need, especially if they need abortion on access to morning after pill, contraception. So it's still on the shoulders of women's groups, civil society, and I'm afraid it will stay that way for some time.
Thank you very much, Wanda, for your availability. We really appreciate your input to this podcast and for your very valuable work you are doing in Poland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Esther. Thank you for what you are doing. I think it is important that the world knows what's happening in Ukraine and in Poland. Thank you so much.
My next guest is Alison Matlak, who is a freelance journalist specialized in assisted reproduction based in Canada. Hello, Alison. Thank you so much for being here today with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Alison, the previous speakers on this podcast, Galina and Wanda, emphasized how being pregnant in Ukraine or as a refugee can put women in a vulnerable position. It is really very rarely mentioned how pregnant women in surrogacy situation, and in fact, all parties involved in surrogacy arrangements, including the newborns and the intended parents, can be in a particular vulnerable situation. You very quickly and recently published an article in The Atlantic that points to these vulnerabilities. Can you please describe the situation in more details?
So what interested me is the thought that there are women in Ukraine right now, many of them, hundreds of them, who are pregnant with children who are not their own. So they're children that technically belong to another family. And it's hard enough to decide what you should do if you're pregnant in wartime, but it's extremely hard to decide what to do when you're pregnant in wartime and you are caring for in your own body the child that you intend to give to somebody else. So it just hit me how much more difficult that must be.
So what are the nuances of this arrangement? I mean, the Ukrainian law is one of the most liberal law on surrogacy in the world. So what are the nuances of this legal arrangement and what are the nuances that applies in the current situation?
Well, I have never seen an actual contract, but what I hear about the contracts is that there are some women, for instance, who are staying in Kyiv right now. They've been offered safe passage out of the city, but they're staying in Kyiv because they've been told, I understand, by the company or clinic that they must give birth in Kyiv if they want to complete the surrogacy. So, for instance, if possibly if they want to get paid for the work that they've done so far, they have to give birth in the place where they said they would give birth, even though that is now a place that's under attack. So that's one example. Another example is women who work for other agencies where the agency said, we're not willing to take this risk on behalf of the intended parents. We want you to leave your hometown. We want you to move to a safe place. Initially, the safe place was Lviv, and the women agreed reluctantly to move to a place of safety in the West. Recently, I heard that those same women who I was tracking a couple of weeks ago have moved to Poland. So now the women, as a part of a condition maybe of their surrogacy, have been asked to move to Poland. Maybe they want to go to Poland, but maybe they don't want to go to Poland. Poland puts them at risk in a way, in that they're carrying a child that belongs to someone else. But in Poland, if they give birth, that child will be legally theirs.
So basically, these arrangements, like many surrogacy arrangements, when it's well done and protects the rights and interests of all parties, including the surrogate woman, the fetus and the future child, the intended parents. So these contracts usually plays out in a way that they provide protection to the pregnant woman and to the newborn, and at the same time protect the interest of the intended parents as well. At the same time, as you pointed out in your article in the Atlantic, that there are expectations for the woman to eat certain food, live to a nearby hospital, and so on, that they might not be able to keep this arrangement, not even mentioning about that what happens if, due to stress of whatsoever, they miscarry or they face other difficulties, how it plays out. So what are the actual questions that are occurring due to this situation that may cause legal and other issues among the parties and between the parties?
Well, again, I have not actually seen any contracts written out, but let's presume that a contract provides some kind of protection for both sides. I mean, some of the questions are the ones that you've mentioned. I mean, what happens if you decide to not live in the bomb shelter that they provide you? What happens if you want to be with your own children? You want to go to your own children and take care of them in wartime, or your own mother or sister. What if you want to move to a country? Maybe you want to move to Romania and be safe there. Romania also does not recognize surrogacy, and so you would be changing the arrangement, basically. What happens if you want to fight for your country? Do you have that right? What will happen to your arrangement? I mean, the questions are limitless, really, because it's really bringing the question of what's paramount here, the woman and her autonomy or her obligation to this other family.
There are other parties in this arrangement, the newborn child when the woman gives birth, and there are the intended parents who, not to forget about, are also very vulnerable in this situation. They are people who went through different assisted reproductive procedures without success, or tried adoption in their home countries and they couldn't. So having such a surrogacy arrangement legally is an amazing opportunity for them. Where these intended parents are coming from and what kind of difficulties they are facing in this situation.
I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it is. Surrogacy is always difficult. It's even more difficult when it's in a foreign country, and now they have to deal with wartime. So we have parents who 3 or 4 weeks ago were planning to go and collect their children. They had their tickets booked. They were going to go to Ukraine and collect their children. And now they find that their children have been born into a war zone. And if you can imagine, they're looking at options like having military teams remove them, extracting them. They're looking at options of hiring a nanny to take care of their baby in a basement bomb shelter until they can somehow either get the baby out to them or get in to get the baby. These are things that even when you paint the most treacherous picture, you'd never imagine having to consider such things. Some of these babies are born early, prematurely, and they need medical care in places that are overwhelmed right now with military injuries. So, I mean, I can't imagine what these people are going through, but it's got to be rough.
And there are the newborns whose the nature of such kind of surrogacy contracts are, and international law primarily protects the best interest of the newborn and the child who has been born. And international law points out that always the primary consideration of such contracts has to be the best interest of the newborn and the child. So there is the third party, or the first party also in this situation, the newborn, the child themselves, right?
And certainly the best interest of the child right now is to be protected and fed and kept safe. I mean, that has to be the best interest of the child right now, no matter how that's done.
Alison, when I read your article on the 10th of March in The Atlantic, I was so impressed that there is a person who cares about this situation and points out the fact, and you put out information so quickly. How could you do that?
So, yeah, I mean, my main area that I write about these days is assisted reproduction. So I have a newsletter, Hey Reprotech, that's been around for 3 years or so, looking generally at assisted reproduction. But once I started to realize that there was rumblings of war in Ukraine, I started sort of a temporary newsletter called Ukraine Surrogacy Dispatches. And it really is just trying to follow any piece of the story from the part of the intended parents, from the side of the surrogate, from the embryologists, to try to paint a picture of what's happening right now with really one of the biggest international surrogacy hubs in the world when suddenly, you know, hit by a war.
Thank you so much, Alison. We so much appreciate for your great work in this area and being here with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I welcome my next guest on this podcast episode, who is Dr. Henya Dakak, Head of Policy and Liaison Unit at the Humanitarian Office of the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. Hello, Henya. Thank you very much for being here today with us from Moldova.
Thank you so much for hosting me. I'm glad that I able to support in really amplifying the situation in Moldova, but overall the situation of sexual and reproductive health and rights in this very fast evolving situation of the Ukraine crisis. It has an implication not only on women and girls in Ukraine, but also on women and girls in the neighboring countries who are leaving Ukraine and trying to find refuge in different countries across Europe. So the situation at the moment is definitely very fast moving, very fluid, and very concerning on many ways and many fronts.
So Henya, UNFPA is one of the lead agencies who organizes sexual and reproductive health support for affected populations and situations like as it is in relation to the war against Ukraine. So as you mentioned, affected populations are within Ukraine, internally displaced populations, and also people who are seeking refuge in other countries. Is UNFPA and partner support includes all of these population groups?
Yes. In terms of what we try to do in many of these situations is we try to really address needs. Okay. And definitely the humanitarian work is about addressing the needs. It's definitely, you know, we follow all the humanitarian principles in terms of really focusing on the needs of population that is most probably is facing hardship. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter what type of religion or ethnic group they belong to. The idea that we really address their needs. And of course, in many of these situations, the biggest needs will always be food, water, sanitation, shelter, but definitely health is very important. And definitely sexual and reproductive health are very, very important issues in this type of setting. It is not like a lot of people don't understand that it is a life-saving. Sexual and reproductive health is a life-saving. It's not a commodity. It's not a luxury. It's really life-saving for many of the women and girls. We are working with many UN agencies and international NGOs and local NGOs and women-led organization and youth-led organization. We see a lot of volunteers that are helping us also. We have a network of what we call them youth volunteers, peers, educators, who have been educated to provide support on issues related to sexual and reproductive health to other peers. But at the moment, we have activated all of them because the needs are huge. At the moment, we know the numbers in Ukraine of displacement is happening every day. So if there is active bombardment, people are moving to areas where they feel more safer, but people are moving all the time. And we have seen an outpour of people outside of Ukraine into neighboring countries. So the needs for women and girls, which, as you know, at the moment, almost 89% of the people who are moving out of Ukraine are women and children. Men cannot move. So we are looking at the majority are women and girls, almost 90%.
Thank you very much. Henya, to address the gap that people face in such situations, the Interagency Working Group for Reproductive Health in Crisis developed the Minimum Initial Service Package for Sexual and Reproductive Health in Crisis Situation. How this package is provided in the current situation?
Of course,
what is this package? Can you also tell what is this package actually?
You know, the Interagency Working Group on Reproductive Health in Crisis, and UNFPA was part and parcel of this effort by the interagency. So this is not like we were part of forming this group, and we are still very active in terms of providing technical support to the group and implementing a lot of the guidance that has been provided over the years and the packages that were developed over the years to really provide the minimum initial service package. So the initial service package is about what are the minimum elements that we need to put in place to address sexual and reproductive health needs of affected population. And in this case, you know, we are really focusing on really how do we prevent sexual violence from happening? How do we address the needs of life-saving activities like emergency obstetric care? How do we make sure that contraceptives are available and a variety of contraceptives are available? So at least women who basically wants to be able to access contraceptives can do that. We're also working on how do we prevent HIV, AIDS, and sexually transmitted infection in this situation. And at the same time, while doing all of this, so while we are doing all of this, is to really make sure that it is coordinated effort, okay? No one agency can do everything, but we need all our partners. We need all the agencies that can provide support for sexual and reproductive health to come forward and support that. That's not, you know, enough to say that, because we need also the governments to be also on board on this. So we cannot say it's only the international community or it's the national community. It's also the governments. And luckily, some of the governments at the moment, with the outpour support also for the population, you know, like that is now under a big hardship, like Ukrainian population, everybody wants to support. All the countries and governments have really given more or less open policy to really host the community that is coming over the border. So that's very good. That's fantastic. We have not seen that happen in Europe for many, many years. Now it's happening. So this is good. But the situation is these countries have their own also laws, and they have their own way of doing things. And I think sometimes people fall between the cracks in terms of understanding what are the laws and what is available for them. So part of the minimum initial service package is that you need to provide the services, you need to provide the information, you need to also make sure that you also coordinate and you plan for a more comprehensive, because the minimum is not going to take us for a long period of time. Most probably we need to move very fast also to go into more comprehensive, because this is a population that's coming across the border. Some of them are elderly, so you might have issues with most probably cervical cancer, other issues. That's why you need more sophisticated sometimes support for certain elements. So that's why at the moment in Moldova and in Poland and in Hungary and Romania, the governments are doing their best. But the reality of the matter is not enough, okay? We are talking about, let us say, a small country like Moldova. They have 4% increase in their population coming, because you are talking about small country, and now you have more 100,000 population that they haven't anticipated. They haven't planned for them. So definitely all the resources are stretched. So at the moment, we are providing them with sexual, what we call them, interagency reproductive health kits, which have all the supplies and materials and commodities that are needed for different elements of the reproductive health needs to address them specifically. So there are kits specifically for the life-saving elements. There are kits specifically to really prevent sexually transmitted infections, also HIV, STIs, you know, all of that is there. But at the same time, we also have the contraceptives that women need. We also have the post-abortion care elements. We all have these elements that are needed for women who are, you know, on the move, or women who are in this type of situation where services might be constrained by different reasons. It could be that they haven't really planned for it. It could be that people might not have been trained, for example, on clinical management of rape, and you need to really set up very quickly something that would be helpful for the women who have experienced some sort of sexual violence or gender-based violence or intimate partner violence.
Are these kits also provided for the Ukrainian population, whether displaced or living in different cities and the countryside? And what kind of challenges are you facing to provide such a comprehensive services for different population groups and humanitarian support?
I think, you know, I mean, the kits that we have talked about are provided inside Ukraine, and we have luckily, UNFPA had already a humanitarian program before for Eastern Ukraine. And we had, of course, part of what we did is pre-position these reproductive health kits for the Ukraine way before. But of course, the challenge at the moment, you know, is people are moving. So they are moving very fast from one place to another. We have like a good network of partners that we work with, but they are also moving from one place to another. So the element at the moment is really how do we continue supporting them while they are moving, and how do we make sure that we move the commodities from one place to another very quickly, and how to support places where it has been destroyed. At the same time, we have been able to provide the same support that we are providing inside Ukraine to different areas, to Moldova, where we have already a presence and a country, a program. So, and we have been working with the government of Moldova, and luckily, you know, they supported the refugees with medical health and medical supplies, and they have been able to really support the response. But they also are facing a lot of challenges. They don't have enough to cover everybody for a long period of time. At the moment, what I can tell you is the humanitarian response in Moldova is costing the government no more than 1 million per day. Okay, we are talking about a country and a government that cannot afford all of these type of expenses. So we have to really support them to make sure that the supplies, that the commodities that they need is available, especially for sexual and reproductive health, because that's missing. But at the same time, there are challenges in other countries where we don't have presence, where we are not, you know what I mean, because they are like well-developed countries, they have well-developed systems, but they might not be as open to sexual and reproductive health agenda. And that's where the challenge is going to be. We are going to face challenges there because we need to really work with them to really address some of the barriers that women have in terms of getting contraceptives or getting certain services that they are accustomed to in Ukraine, but they are not finding them very available in the countries where they are settling at the moment, or whether they are settling or transiting, you know what I mean? Because some of them are transiting. They come to Romania, for example, or Moldova, and then move to other countries. So I'll stop here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much, Henya, for your availability. We really, really appreciate, and we are wishing you all the best to you and your colleagues in this hard work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My last speaker on this podcast episode is Christina Zampas, who is the Associate Director of Global Advocacy at the Center for Reproductive Rights. Hello, Christina.
Hello, Esther. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for participating in this podcast. Christina, you are a lead author of the Center's recently published technical paper on Accountability for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights in Humanitarian Settings, which paper examines the role and relationship of diverse branches of international law. We heard from our previous speakers on this podcast, and in any way, we are hearing about it every day on television and radio and the media about the gross human rights violations, dangers, life and health hazards people are facing in relation to their sexual and reproductive health and rights in the situation of the war against Ukraine. Can you just please tell us more about how human rights law and how human rights apply in this kind of situation?
Thanks. That's a really important question, because it's oftentimes we hear that in dire situations like the one we're seeing in the Ukraine, that sometimes many different actors dismiss human rights and say, well, it's too complicated. The situation is too dire. Human rights are the lead of concern in these situations. And I just want to emphasize, actually, that human rights apply during armed conflict. In fact, international human rights law applies in all contexts, during war and during peace. So human rights are not suspended during this time. Yes, there are some limitations which can be allowed, but there have to be very limited, and there must be very proportional to reach that limited aim. And in under no circumstances are some human rights actually able to be suspended. For example, the right to life and the right to torture and other ill treatment, two rights which are really super important in the context of armed conflict and also in the context of ensuring access to sexual and reproductive health services.
Christina, people are confused, and beside human rights lawyers and those who are working in this area don't necessarily understand that is there a hierarchy between international humanitarian law, criminal law, international criminal law, international human rights law? How do we understand the relationship of international law in a situation like this?
It's been long established, and that's true for international humanitarian law, international criminal law, and international human rights law, that these bodies of law are complementary and mutually reinforcing. So there is not necessarily a hierarchy. International humanitarian law specifically only applies in armed conflict. In other words, the body of law that governs war. And it sets forth obligations on warring parties, on what they can and cannot do during war, and sets forth specific protections and obligations regarding civilians as well. So that would apply to the situations that we're seeing and what you're talking about with regards to women and other persons in accessing sexual and reproductive health services. But these bodies of law are mutually reinforcing, and human rights law actually has been used as a source to help interpret both of these other bodies of law as well.
So can it be, for example, it was yesterday when this recording is happening, that it's second time that a maternity hospital was bombed. So that is being now questioned and investigated whether it's constituted as a war crime. But it also means that people don't have access to health services. So any other international law like CEDAW and others would also apply in terms of obstruction of access to health services. This is what you meant when you say that international law is complementary in this situation.
Yes, there's nothing, there are no contradictions between those laws. For example, humanitarian law prohibits the bombing of maternity hospitals. That's actually explicit in the Geneva Conventions, which are the laws that we talk about when we say humanitarian law, the treaties that we talk about. So actually, protection of maternity hospitals is expressly stated. And under human rights law, it's absolutely clear that access to sexual and reproductive health services, services for pregnant persons, are protected under the CEDAW Convention, but also under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and other human rights treaties.
So what is the relevance, for example, if bombing a maternity hospital is considered to be a war crime? Why does it matter?
Well, if it falls under a war crime, then there can be a criminal prosecution under the Rome Statute, and the perpetrators can be brought to the International Criminal Court. So you have criminal responsibility. But it's really important to remember, while that is essential for accountability and essential for redress for the survivors of that experience, generally for the country in this case, it's really important to see that a lot of other actors are also responsible for ensuring access to sexual and reproductive health services, so that it's not just isolated to criminal prosecution, which is a very high threshold and standard to meet. So that's where actually they are very complementary if you look at criminal law, humanitarian law, and human rights law.
So you mentioned the Rome Statute. Both of our organizations in a process of preparing a contribution to a new policy of the International Criminal Court on gender aspects of the International Criminal Court and criminal prosecution. How gender plays out in a situation in relation to sexual and reproductive health and rights like this?
Well, you see both under international humanitarian law and international criminal law, most of the protections concerning women are related to women as survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, usually just sexual violence, actually, and then also women as pregnant. So, for example, in international humanitarian law, there's express provisions protecting pregnant women and express provisions protecting persons who have been victims of sexual violence, which is very, very important that those are there and that protection is given to those persons. But it's also important that humanitarian law and criminal law are specifically expanded to protect broader groups of civilians. So all women, for example, should have access to sexual and reproductive health services, which is actually recognized under human rights law. The CEDAW Committee does not say that only survivors of sexual violence should have access to these services. So it's important to expand that and not to stereotype women as only victims of violence or future mother, as it's portrayed in international humanitarian law. That's women, and it doesn't encompass the range of problems we see. And just to say on that note, similarly, and even more flagrantly absent in humanitarian law and criminal law, is protections of persons of diverse sexual orientations and gender identities. It's hardly mentioned in the new commentaries under international humanitarian law. But under international human rights law, there are relatively, compared to the other bodies of law, strong protections. And those protections should also be reflected in humanitarian law and criminal law expressly as well.
So in the context of international standards, I think it's also very important to talk about not only about international human rights law and the body of law, but also health standards. For example, the minimum standards of provision of care in the context of humanitarian crisis, or the most recently launched safe abortion guidance by WHO. Can you say a couple of words, Christina, about the applicability and importance of these public health standards?
Yeah, the public health standards are, I think, super important. And actually, they're all rooted in human rights as well. So what you see in, for example, WHO's new abortion care guidelines and what you see in the minimal initial service package for reproductive health, which is to be applied in humanitarian settings, are all obligations under human rights law as well. So it's an area where public health and human rights actually coalesce. They come together. And I think it's super important and important for humanitarian actors to know. When I say that, I mean anyone providing services in humanitarian settings, donor countries as well, understand that these are also human rights obligations that they have. So donor countries have human rights obligations in humanitarian settings, even if they're not directly, let's say, involved in the armed conflict. They certainly have that, and they should be following these recommendations and also their obligations as well.
My last question, Christina, is about accountability. What does it really mean? Who is accountable for respecting and protecting and fulfilling sexual and reproductive rights in a situation like this?
Well, first of all parties to the conflict are responsible for realizing human rights. Donor countries are also responsible through their funding schemes, whether they're providing services directly or indirectly. Non-state actors, including civil society organizations and others who are providing humanitarian services, should be providing humanitarian services following the principles of humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence, which are rooted in human rights. And also, it's just important to just remember that human rights, including sexual and reproductive rights, are not just an add-on in the humanitarian response. Rights are essential to an effective response for protection of persons and also for duty bearers to fulfill their obligations under international law, including donor countries.
Thank you very much, Christina. I really appreciate your participation in this podcast episode. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Esther. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the SRHM podcast. And thank you to all speakers for sharing their insights. You can find the links to the various resources mentioned by the speaker in this episode description. To learn more about SRHR in humanitarian crisis, please visit our journal website at srhmjournal.org and read our latest editorial on the topic there. Thank you for supporting the SRHM podcast, which is produced by SRHM colleagues in collaboration with our editors at The Edit Podcast. The music was composed by Tiber Christian and Shalamon Boton.